fate of the ring. My heart tells me that he has some part to play yet, for good or ill, before the end, and when that comes, the pity of Bilbo may rule the fate of many, yours not least. In any case, we didn't kill him. He is very old and very wretched. The wood elves have him in prison, but they treat him with such kindness as they can find in their wise hearts.
All the same, said Frodo, even if Bilbo couldn't kill Gollum, I wish he hadn't kept the ring. I wish he had never found it, and that I had not got it. Why did you let me keep it? Why didn't you make me throw it away, or destroy it?
Let you? Make you? Said the wizard. Haven't you been listening to all that I have said? You are not thinking of what you are saying. But as for throwing it away, that was obviously wrong. These rings have a way of being found. In evil hands, it might have done great evil. Worst of all, it might have fallen into the hands of the enemy. Indeed, it certainly would, for this is the one, and he is exerting all his power to find it or draw it to himself. Of course, my dear Frodo, it was dangerous for you, and that has troubled me deeply. But there was so much at stake that I had to take some risk, though even when I was far away, there has never been a day when the Shire has not been guarded by watchful eyes. As long as you never used it, I did not think that the ring would have any lasting effect on you. Not for evil, not at any rate for a very long time. And you must remember that 9 years ago, when I last saw you, I still knew little for certain.
But why not destroy it, as you say should have been done long ago? Cried Frodo again. If you had warned me, or even sent me a message, I would have done away with it.
Would you? How would you do that? Have you ever tried?
No, but I suppose one could hammer it or melt it.
Try, said Gandalf. Try now. Frodo drew the ring out of his pocket again and looked at it. It now appeared plain and smooth, without mark or device that he could see. The gold looked very fair and pure, and Frodo thought how rich and beautiful was its colour, how perfect was its roundness. It was an admirable thing and altogether precious. When he took it out, he had intended to fling it from him into the very hottest part of the fire, but he found now that he could not do so, not without a great struggle. He weighed the ring in his hand, hesitating, and forcing himself to remember all that Gandalf had told him. And then, with an effort of will, he made a movement, as if to cast it away, but he found that he had put it back in his pocket.
Gandalf laughed grimly. You see? Already you too, Frodo, cannot easily let it go, nor will to damage it. And I could not make you, except by force, which would break your mind. But as for breaking the ring, force is useless. Even if you took it and struck it with a heavy sledgehammer, it would make no dint in it. It cannot be unmade by your hands or by mine. Your small fire, of course, would not melt even ordinary gold. This ring has already passed through it unscathed and even unheated. But there is no smith's forge in this shire that could change it at all. Not even the anvils and furnaces of the dwarves could do that. It has been said that dragon fire could melt and consume the rings of power, but there is not now any dragon left on earth in which the old fire is hot enough. Nor was there ever any dragon, not even Uncalagon the Black, who could have harmed the One Ring, the Ruling Ring, for that was made by Sauron himself.
There is only one way, to find the cracks of doom in the depths of Orodruin, the Fire Mountain, and cast the ring in there, if you really wish to destroy it, to put it beyond the grasp of the enemy for ever.
I do really wish to destroy it, cried Frodo, or, well, to have it destroyed. I'm not made for perilous quests. I wish I'd never seen the ring. Why did it come to me? Why was I chosen?
Such questions cannot be answered, said Gandalf. You may be sure that it was not for any merit that others do not possess, not for power or wisdom at any rate. But you have been chosen, and you must therefore use such strength and heart and wits as you have.
But I've so little of any of these things. You are wise and powerful. Will you not take the ring?
No, cried Gandalf, springing to his feet. With that power I should have power too great and terrible, and over me the ring would gain a power still greater and more deadly.
His eyes flashed, and his face was lit as by a fire within.
"Do not tempt me, for I do not wish to become like the Dark Lord himself. Yet the way of the ring to my heart is by pity. Pity for weakness and the desire of strength to do good. Do not tempt me. I dare not take it, not even to keep it safe, unused. The wish to wield it would be too great for my strength. I shall have such need of it. Great perils lie before me."
He went to the window and drew aside the curtains and the shutters. Sunlight streamed back again into the room. Sam passed along the path outside, whistling.
"And now," said the wizard, turning back to Frodo, "the decision lies with you, but I will always help you."
He laid his hand on Frodo's shoulder.
"I will help you bear this burden as long as it is yours to bear, but we must do something soon. The enemy is moving."
There was a long silence. Gandalf sat down again and puffed at his pipe, as if lost in thought. His eyes seemed closed, but under the lids he was watching Frodo intently. Frodo gazed fixedly at the red embers on the hearth until they filled all his vision, and he seemed to be looking down into profound wells of fire. He was thinking of the fabled cracks of doom and the terror of the fiery mountain.
"Well," said Gandalf at last, "what are you thinking about? Have you decided what to do?"
"No," answered Frodo, coming back to himself out of darkness, and finding to his surprise that it was not dark, and that out of the window he could see the sunlit garden. "Or perhaps, yes, as far as I understand what you have said, I suppose I must keep the ring and guard it, at least for the present, whatever it may do to me."
"Whatever it may do, it will be slow, slow to evil, if you keep it with that purpose," said Gandalf.
"I hope so," said Frodo. "But I hope that you may find some other better keeper soon. But in the meanwhile it seems that I am a danger to all that live near me. I cannot keep the ring and stay here. I ought to leave Bag End, leave the Shire, leave everything and go away," he sighed. "I should like to save the Shire, if I could, though there have been times when I thought the inhabitants too stupid and dull for words, and have felt that an earthquake or an invasion of dragons might be good for them. But I don't feel like that now. I feel that as long as the Shire lies behind, safe and comfortable, I shall find wandering more bearable. I shall know that somewhere there is a firm foothold, even if my feet cannot stand there again. Of course, I have sometimes thought of going away, but I imagined that as a kind of holiday, a series of adventures like Bilbo's or better, ending in peace. But this would mean exile, a flight from danger into danger, drawing it after me. And I suppose I must go alone, if I am to do that and save the Shire. But I feel very small, and very uprooted, and, well, desperate. The enemy is so strong and terrible." He did not tell Gandalf, but as he was speaking, a great desire to follow Bilbo flamed up in his heart. To follow Bilbo, and even perhaps to find him again. It was so strong that it overcame his fear. He could almost have run out there and then down the road without his hat, as Bilbo had done on a similar morning long ago.
"My dear Frodo," exclaimed Gandalf, "hobbits really are amazing creatures, as I've said before. You can learn all that there is to know about their ways in a month, and yet after 100 years they can still surprise you at a pinch. I hardly expected to get such an answer, not even from you. But Bilbo made no mistake in choosing his heir, though he little thought how important it would prove. I'm afraid you are right. The ring will not be able to stay hidden in the Shire much longer, and for your own sake, as well as for others, you will have to go and leave the name of Baggins behind you. That name will not be safe to have, outside the Shire or in the wild. I will give you a travelling name now. When you go, go as Mr. Underhill. But I don't think you need go alone. Not if you know of anyone you can trust, and who would be willing to go by your side, and that you would be willing to take into unknown perils. But if you look for a companion, be careful in choosing, and be careful of what you say, even to your closest friends. The enemy has many spies and many ways of hearing."
Suddenly he stopped, as if listening. Frodo became aware that all was very quiet inside and outside. Gandalf crept to one side of the window. Then with a dart he sprang to the sill and thrust a long arm out and downwards. There was a squawk, and up came Sam Gamgee's curly head, hauled by one ear.
"Well, well, bless my beard," said Gandalf. "Sam Gamgee, is it? Now what may you be doing?"
"Lord bless you, Mr. Gandalf, sir," said Sam. "Nothing. Leastways, I was just trimming the grass border under the window, if you follow me."
He picked up his shears and exhibited them as evidence.
"I don't," said Gandalf grimly. "It is some time since I last heard the sound of your shears. How long have you been eavesdropping?"
"Eavesdropping, sir? I don't follow you, begging your pardon. There ain't no eaves at Bag End, and that's a fact."
"Don't be a fool. What have you heard, and why did you listen?"
Gandalf's eyes flashed, and his brows stuck out like bristles.
"Mr. Frodo, sir," cried Sam, quaking. "Don't let him hurt me, sir. Don't let him turn me into anything unnatural. My old dad would take on so. I meant no harm, on my honour, sir."
"He won't hurt you," said Frodo, hardly able to keep from laughing, although he was himself startled and rather puzzled.
"He knows, as well as I do, that you mean no harm. But just you up and answer his question straight away."
"Well, sir," said Sam, dithering a little, "I heard a deal that I didn't rightly understand about an enemy and rings and Mr. Bilbo, sir, and dragons and a fiery mountain and
elves, sir. I listened because I couldn't help myself, if you know what I mean. Lord bless me, sir, but I do love tales of that sort, and I believe them too. Whatever Ted may say, elves, sir, I would dearly love to see them. Couldn't you take me to see elves, sir, when you go?"
Suddenly Gandalf laughed.
"Come inside," he shouted, and putting out both his arms he lifted the astonished Sam, shears, grass clippings and all, right through the window and stood him on the floor.
"Take you to see elves, eh?" he said,
eyeing Sam closely, but with a smile flickering on his face.
"So you heard that Mr. Frodo is going away?"
"I did, sir, and that's why I choked, which you heard, seemingly. I tried not to, sir, but it burst out of me. I was so upset."
"It can't be helped, Sam," said Frodo sadly. He had suddenly realized that flying from the Shire would mean more painful partings than merely saying farewell to the familiar comforts of Bag End. "I shall have to go, but—" And here he looked hard at Sam. "If you really care about me, you will keep that dead secret, see? If you don't, if you even breathe a word of what you've heard here, then I hope Gandalf will turn you into a spotted toad and fill the garden full of grass snakes." Sam fell on his knees, trembling.
"Get up, Sam," said Gandalf. "I've thought of something better than that, something to shut your mouth and punish you properly for listening. You shall go away with Mr. Frodo."
"Me, sir?"
cried Sam, springing up like a dog invited for a walk.
"Me go and see elves and all? Hooray!"
he shouted, and then burst into tears. Chapter 3 Three is Company.
"You ought to go quietly, and you ought to go soon," said Gandalf. 2 or 3 weeks had passed, and still Frodo made no sign of getting ready to go.
"I know, but it's difficult to do both," he objected. "If I just vanish like Bilbo, the tale will be all over the Shire in no time."
"Of course you mustn't vanish," said Gandalf. "That wouldn't do at all. I said soon, not instantly. If you can think of any way of slipping out of the Shire without its being generally known, it will be worth a little today. But you must not delay too long."
"What about the autumn, or after our birthday?" asked Frodo. "I think I could probably make some arrangements by then." To tell the truth, he was very reluctant to start, now that it had come to the point. Bag End seemed a more desirable residence than it had for years, and he wanted to savour as much as he could of his last summer in the Shire. When autumn came, he knew that part at least of his heart would think more kindly of journeying, as it always did at that season. He had indeed privately made up his mind to leave on his 50th birthday, Bilbo's 128th. It seemed somehow the proper day on which to set out and follow him. Following Bilbo was uppermost in his mind, and the one thing that made the thought of leaving bearable. He thought as little as possible about the ring, and where it might lead him in the end. But he did not tell all his thoughts to Gandalf. What the wizard guessed was always difficult to tell. He looked at Frodo and smiled.
"Very well," he said. "I think that will do, but it must not be any later. I'm getting very anxious. In the meantime, do take care, and don't let out any hint of where you're going, and see that Sam Gamgee doesn't talk. If he does, I really shall turn him into a toad."
"As for where I'm going," said Frodo, "it would be difficult to give that away, for I have no clear idea myself yet."
"Don't be absurd," said Gandalf. "I'm not warning you against leaving an address at the post office. But you are leaving the Shire, and that should not be known until you're far away. And you must go, or at least set out, either north, south, west, or east, and the direction should certainly not be known."
"I've been so taken up with the thoughts of leaving Bag End and of saying farewell that I've never even considered the direction," said Frodo. "For where am I to go, and by what shall I steer? What's to be my quest? Bilbo went to find a treasure, there and back again, but I go to lose one and not return as far as I can see."
"But you can't see very far," said Gandalf. "Neither can I. It may be a task to find the cracks of doom. But that quest may be for others. I don't know. At any rate, you're not ready for that long road yet."
"No, indeed," said Frodo. "But in the meantime, what course am I to take?"
"Towards danger, but not too rashly, nor too straight," answered the wizard. "If you want my advice, make for Rivendell. That journey should not prove too perilous, though the road is less easy than it was, and it will grow worse as the year fails."
"Rivendell," said Frodo. "Very good. I will go east, and I will make for Rivendell. I'll take Sam to visit the elves. He'll be delighted." He spoke lightly, but his heart was moved suddenly with a desire to see the house of Elrond Half-Elven, and breathe the air of that deep valley where many of the fair folk still dwelt in peace. One summer's evening an astonishing piece of news reached the Ivy Bush and Green Dragon. Giants and other portents on the borders of the Shire were forgotten for more important matters. Mr. Frodo was selling Bag End. Indeed, he'd already sold it to the Sackville Bagginses.
"For a nice bit, too," said some. "At a bargain priced," said others. "And that's more likely when Mistress Lobelia's the buyer."
Otho had died some years before, at the ripe but disappointed age of 102. Just why Mr. Frodo was selling his beautiful hole was even more debatable than the price. A few held the theory, supported by the nods and hints of Mr. Baggins himself, that Frodo's money was running out. He was going to leave Hobbiton and live in a quiet way on the proceeds of the sale down in Buckland among his Brandybuck relations.
"As far from the Sackville Bagginses as may be," some added.
But so firmly fixed had the notion of the immeasurable wealth of the Bagginses of Bag End become, that most found this hard to believe, harder than any other reason or unreason that their fancy could suggest. To most it suggested a dark and yet unrevealed plot by Gandalf. Though he kept himself very quiet and did not go about by day, it was well known that he was hiding up in the Bag End. But however a removal might fit in with the designs of his wizardry, there was no doubt about the fact. Frodo Baggins was going back to Buckland. "Yes, I shall be moving this autumn," he said. "Merry Brandybuck is looking out for a nice little hole for me, or perhaps a small house." As a matter of fact, with Merry's help, he had already chosen and bought a little house at Crick Hollow in the country beyond Bucklebury. To all but Sam, he pretended he was going to settle down there permanently. The decision to set out eastwards had suggested the idea to him, for Buckland was on the eastern borders of the Shire, and as he had lived there in childhood, his going back would at least seem credible. Gandalf stayed in the Shire for over 2 months. Then one evening, at the end of June, soon after Frodo's plan had been finally arranged, he suddenly announced that he was going off again next morning.
"Only for a short while, I hope," he said.
but I'm going down beyond the southern borders to get some news, if I can. I've been idle longer than I should." He spoke lightly, but it seemed to Frodo that he looked rather worried. "Has anything happened?" he asked.
"Well, no, but I've heard something that has made me anxious and needs looking into. If I think it necessary, after all, for you to get off at once, I shall come back immediately, or at least send word. In the meanwhile, stick to your plan, but be more careful than ever, especially the ring. Let me impress on you once more, don't use it."
He went off at dawn.
"I may be back any day," he said. "At the very latest, I shall come back for the farewell party. I think, after all, you may need my company on the road."
At first, Frodo was a good deal disturbed, and wondered often what Gandalf could have heard. But his uneasiness wore off, and in the fine weather he forgot his troubles for a while. The Shire had seldom seen so fair a summer, or so rich an autumn. The trees were laden with apples, honey was dripping in the combs, and the corn was tall and full. Autumn was well under way before Frodo began to worry about Gandalf again. September was passing, and there was still no news of him. The birthday and the removal drew nearer, and still he didn't come or send word. Bag End began to be busy. Some of Frodo's friends came to stay and help him with the packing. There was Fredegar Bulger and Falco Boffin, and of course his special friends Pippin Took and Mary Brandybuck. Between them they turned the whole place upside down. On September the 20th, two covered carts went off laden to Buckland, conveying the furniture and goods that Frodo had not sold to his new home by way of the Brandywine Bridge. The next day Frodo became really anxious and kept a constant lookout for Gandalf. Thursday, his birthday morning, dawned as fair and clear as it had long ago for Bilbo's great party. Still Gandalf did not appear. In the evening Frodo gave his farewell feast. It was quite small, just a dinner for himself and his four helpers. But he was troubled and felt in no mood for it. The thought that he would so soon have to part with his young friends weighed on his heart. He wondered how he would break it to them. The four younger hobbits were, however, in high spirits, and the party soon became very cheerful in spite of Gandalf's absence. The dining-room was bare except for a table and chairs, but the food was good, and there was good wine. Frodo's wine had not been included in the sale to the Sackville Bagginses. "Whatever happens to the rest of my stuff, when the SBs get their claws on it, at any rate, I've found a good home for this," said Frodo as he drained his glass. It was the last drop of Old Wynyards. When they'd sung many songs and talked of many things they'd done together, they toasted Bilbo's birthday, and they drank his health and Frodo's together, according to Frodo's custom. Then they went out for a sniff of air and glimpse of the stars, and then they went to bed. Frodo's party was over, and Gandalf had not come. The next morning they were busy packing another cart with the remainder of the luggage. Merry took charge of this, and drove off with Fatty, that is, Fredegar Bulger. "Someone must get there and warm the house before you arrive," said Merry. "Well, see you later. The day after tomorrow, if you don't go to sleep on the way." Falco went home after lunch, but Pippin remained behind. Frodo was restless and anxious, listening in vain for a sound of Gandalf. He decided to wait until nightfall. After that, if Gandalf wanted him urgently, he would go to Crick Hollow, and might even get there first, for Frodo was going on foot. His plan, for pleasure and a last look at the Shire as much as for any other reason, was to walk from Hobbiton to Bucklebury Ferry, taking it fairly easy. "I shall get myself a bit into training, too," he said, looking at himself in a dusty mirror in the half-empty hall. He hadn't done any strenuous walking for a long time, and the reflection looked rather flabby, he thought. After lunch, the Sackville Bagginses, Lobelia and her sandy-haired son, Lotho, turned up, much to Frodo's annoyance.
"Ours at last," said Lobelia, as she stepped inside.
It was not polite, nor strictly true, for the sale of Bag End did not take effect until midnight. But Lobelia can perhaps be forgiven. She had been obliged to wait about 77 years longer for Bag End than she once hoped, and she was now 100 years old. Anyway, she'd come to see that nothing she paid for had been carried off, and she wanted the keys. It took a long while to satisfy her, as she'd brought a complete inventory with her and went right through it. In the end she departed with Lotho and the spare key and the promise that the other key would be left at the Ganges in Bagshot Row. She snorted and showed plainly that she thought the Ganges capable of plundering the hole during the night. Frodo did not offer her any tea. He took his own tea with Pippin and Sam Gamgee in the kitchen. It had been officially announced that Sam was coming to Buckland to do for Mr. Frodo and look after his bit of garden, an arrangement that was approved by the gaffer, though it did not console him for the prospect of having Lobelia as a neighbour. "Our last meal at Bag End," said Frodo, pushing back his chair. They left the washing up for Lobelia. Pippin and Sam strapped up their three packs and piled them in the porch. Pippin went out for a last stroll in the garden. Sam disappeared. The sun went down. Bag End seemed sad and gloomy and dishevelled. Frodo wandered round the familiar rooms and saw the light of the sunset fade on the walls and shadows creep out of the corners. It grew slowly dark indoors. He went out and walked down to the gate at the bottom of the path, and then on a short way, down the hill road. He half expected to see Gandalf come striding up through the dusk. The sky was clear and the stars were growing bright. "It's going to be a fine night," he said aloud. "That's good for a beginning. I feel like walking. I can't bear any more hanging about. I'm going to start, and Gandalf must follow me." He turned to go back, and then stopped, for he heard voices, just round the corner by the end of Bagshot Row. One voice was certainly the old gaffer's. The other was strange, and somehow unpleasant. He couldn't make out what it said, but he heard the gaffer's answers, which were rather shrill. The old man seemed put out.
"No, Mr. Baggins has gone away. I went this morning, and my Sam went with him. Anyway, all his stuff went. Yes, sold out and gone, I tell ye. Why? Why, it's none of my business or yours. Where to? That ain't no secret. He's moved to Bucklebury or some such place. Away down yonder. Yes, it is a tidy way. I've never been so far myself. They're queer folks in Buckland. No, I can't give no message. Good night to you."
Footsteps went away down the hill. Frodo wondered vaguely why the fact that they did not come on up the hill seemed a great relief. "I'm sick of questions and curiosity about my doings, I suppose," he thought. "What an inquisitive lot they all are." He'd half a mind to go and ask the gaffer who the inquirer was, but he thought better or worse of it, and turned and walked quickly back to Bag End. Pippin was sitting on his pack in the porch. Sam was not there. Frodo stepped inside the dark door. "Sam," he called. "Sam."
"Time."
"Coming, sir," came the answer from far within, followed soon by Sam himself, wiping his mouth. He'd been saying farewell to the beer barrel in the cellar.
"All aboard, Sam," said Frodo. "Yes, sir. I'll last for a bit now, sir."
Frodo shut and locked the round door and gave the key to Sam. "Run down with this to your home, Sam," he said. "Then cut along the row and meet us as quick as you can at the gate in the lane beyond the meadows. We are not going through the village tonight. Too many ears pricking and eyes prying." Sam ran off at full speed.
"Well, now we're off at last," said Frodo.
They shouldered their packs and took up their sticks and walked round the corner to the west side of Bag End. "Goodbye," said Frodo, looking at the dark, blank windows. He waved his hand and then turned and, following Bilbo, if he had known it, hurried after Peregrine down the garden path. They jumped over the low place in the hedge at the bottom and took to the fields, passing into the darkness like a rustle in the grasses. At the bottom of the hill on its western side they came to the gate opening on to a narrow lane. There they halted and adjusted the straps of their packs. Presently Sam appeared, trotting quickly and breathing hard. His heavy pack was hoisted high on his shoulders, and he had put on his head a tall, shapeless felt bag, which he called a hat. In the gloom he looked very much like a dwarf. "I'm sure you've given me all the heavier stuff," said Frodo. "I pity snails, and all that carry their homes on their backs."
"'I could take a little more yet, sir.' "'My packet is quite light,' said Sam, stoutly and untruthfully.
"'No, you don't, Sam,' said Pippin. "'It's good for him. "'He's got nothing except what he ordered us to pack. "'He's been slack lately, and he'll feel the weight less "'when he's walked off some of his own.'
"'Be kind to a poor old hobbit,' laughed Frodo. "'I shall be as thin as a willow wand, I'm sure, before I get to Buckland. "'But I was talking nonsense. "'I suspect you've taken more than your fair share, Sam, "'and I shall look into it at our next packing.' "'He picked up his stick again. "'Well, we all like walking in the dark,' he said. "'So let's put some miles behind us before bed.' "'For a short way they followed the lane westwards. "'Then, leaving it, they turned left and took quietly to the fields again.' They went in single file along hedgerows and the borders of coppices, and a night fell dark about them. In their dark cloaks they were as invisible as if they had all had magic rings. Since they were all hobbits, and were trying to be silent, they made no noise that even hobbits would hear. Even the wild things in the fields and woods hardly noticed their passing. After some time they crossed the water, west of Hobbiton, by a narrow plank bridge. The stream was there no more than a winding black ribbon, bordered with leaning alder trees. A mile or two further south they hastily crossed the great road from the Brandywine Bridge. They were now in the Tookland, and bending southeastwards they made for the green hill country. As they began to climb its first slopes, they looked back and saw the lamps in Hobbiton far off, twinkling in the gentle valley of the water. Soon it disappeared in the folds of the darkened land, and was followed by Bywater beside its grey pool. When the light of the last farm was far behind, peeping among the trees, Frodo turned and waved a hand in farewell. "'I wonder if I shall ever look down into that valley again,' he said quietly. When they'd walked for about 3 hours, they rested. The night was clear, cool and starry, but smoke-like wisps of mist were creeping up the hillsides from the streams and deep meadows. Thin-clad birches, swaying in a light wind above their heads, made a black net against the pale sky. They ate a very frugal supper, for hobbits, and then went on again. Soon they struck a narrow road that went rolling up and down, fading grey into the darkness ahead, the road to Woodhall and Stock, and the Bucklebury Ferry. It climbed away from the main road in the water valley, and wound over the skirts of the green hills towards Woody End, a wild corner of the East Farthing. After a while they plunged into a deeply cloven track between tall trees that rustled their dry leaves in the night. It was very dark. At first they talked, or hummed a tune softly together, being now far away from inquisitive ears. Then they marched on in silence, and Pippin began to lag behind. At last, as they began to climb a steep slope, he stopped and yawned.
"'I am so sleepy,' he said, "'that soon I shall fall down on the road. "'Are you going to sleep on your legs? "'It's nearly midnight.'
"'I thought you liked walking in the dark,' said Frodo. "'But there's no great hurry. "'Merry expects us some time the day after tomorrow, "'but that leaves us nearly 2 days more.' "'We'll halt at the first likely spot.' "'The wind's in the west,' said Sam. "'If we get to the other side of this hill, "'we shall find a spot that's sheltered and snug enough, sir. "'There's a dry fir wood just ahead, if I remember rightly.' "'Sam knew the land well within 20 miles of Hobbiton, "'but that was the limit of his geography. "'Just over the top of the hill they came on the patch of fir wood.' Leaving the road, they went into the deep, resin-scented darkness of the trees and gathered dead sticks and cones to make a fire. Soon they had a merry crackle of flame at the foot of a large fir tree, and they sat round it for a while, until they began to nod. Then, each at an angle at the great tree's roots, they curled up in their cloaks and blankets and were soon fast asleep. They set no watch. Even Frodo feared no danger yet, for they were still in the heart of the Shire. A few creatures came and looked at them when the fire had died away. A fox passing through the wood on business of his own stopped several minutes and sniffed. "Hobbits," he thought. "Well, what next?
I've heard of strange doings in this land, but I've seldom heard of a hobbit sleeping out of doors under a tree. 3 of them. There's something mighty queer behind this.
He was quite right, but he never found out any more about it. The morning came, pale and clammy. Frodo woke up first, and found that a tree root had made a hole in his back, and that his neck was stiff. Walking for pleasure? Why didn't I drive, he thought, as he usually did at the beginning of an expedition. And all my beautiful feather beds are sold to the Sackville Bagginses. These tree roots would do them good, he stretched. Wake up, hobbits, he cried. It's a beautiful morning.
What's beautiful about it? Said Pippin, peering over the edge of his blanket with one eye.
Sam, get breakfast ready for 9:30. Have you got the bathwater hot? Sam jumped up, looking rather bleary.
No, sir, I haven't, sir, he said.
Frodo stripped the blankets from Pippin and rolled him over, and then walked off to the edge of the wood. Away eastward the sun was rising red out of the mist that lay thick on the world. Touched with gold and red, the autumn trees seemed to be sailing rootless in a shadowy sea. A little below him to the left, the road ran down steeply into a hollow and disappeared. When he returned, Sam and Pippin had got a good fire going.
"Water!" shouted Pippin. "Where's the water?"
"I don't keep water in my pocket," said Frodo.
"We thought you had gone to find some," said Pippin, busy setting out the food and cups.
"You'd better go now." "You can come too," said Frodo, "and bring all the water bottles." There was a stream at the foot of the hill. They filled their bottles and the small camping kettle at a little fall where the water fell a few feet over an outcrop of grey stone. It was icy cold, and they spluttered and puffed as they bathed their faces and hands. When their breakfast was over, and their packs all trussed up again, it was after 10 o'clock, and the day was beginning to turn fine and hot. They went down the slope and across the stream where it dived under the road, and up the next slope, and up and down another shoulder of the hills, and by that time their cloaks, blankets, water, food, and other gear already seemed a heavy burden. The day's march promised to be warm and tiring work. After some miles, however, the road ceased to roll up and down. It climbed to the top of a steep bank in a weary, zigzagging sort of way, and then prepared to go down for the last time. In front of them they saw the lower lands dotted with small clumps of trees that melted away in the distance to a brown woodland haze. They were looking across the woody end toward the Brandywine River. The road wound away before them like a piece of string.
"The road goes on forever," said Pippin. "But I can't without a rest. It's high time for lunch."
He sat down on the bank at the side of the road and looked away east into the haze, beyond which lay the river, and the end of the shire in which he had spent all his life. Sam stood by him. His round eyes were wide open, for he was looking across lands he had never seen to a new horizon.
"Do elves live in those woods?" he asked.
"Not that I've ever heard," said Pippin. Frodo was silent. He too was gazing eastward along the road, as if he'd never seen it before. Suddenly he spoke, aloud, but as if to himself, saying slowly, "The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow, if I can, pursuing it with weary feet, until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then I cannot say."
"That sounds like a bit of old Bilbo's rhyming," said Pippin. "Or is it one of your imitations? It doesn't sound altogether encouraging."
"I don't know," said Frodo. "It came to me then, as if I was making it up. But I may have heard it long ago. Certainly it reminds me very much of Bilbo in the last years, before he went away. He used often to say that there was only one road, that it was like a great river. Its springs were at every doorstep, and every path was its tributary. It's a dangerous business, Frodo, going out of your door," he used to say. "You step into the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to. Do you realize that this is the very last path that goes through Mirkwood, and that if you let it, it might take you to the Lonely Mountain, or even further, and to worse places? He used to say that on the path outside the front door at Bag End, especially after he'd been out for a long walk.
"Well, the road won't sweep me anywhere for an hour at least," said Pippin, unslinging his pack.
The others followed his example, putting their packs against the bank and their legs out into the road. After a rest, they had a good lunch, and then more rest. The sun was beginning to get low, and the light of afternoon was on the land as they went down the hill. So far, they'd not met a soul on the road. This way was not much used, being hardly fit for carts, and there was little traffic to the woody end. They'd been jogging along again for an hour or more when Sam stopped a moment as if listening. They were now on level ground, and the road, after much winding, lay straight ahead through grassland sprinkled with tall trees, outliers of the approaching woods.
"I can hear a pony or a horse coming along the road behind," said Sam.
They looked back, but the turn of the road prevented them from seeing far. "I wonder if that is Gandalf coming after us," said Frodo. But even as he said it, he had a feeling that it was not so, and a sudden desire to hide from the view of the rider came over him. "It may not matter much," he said apologetically, "but I would rather not be seen on the road by anyone. I'm sick of my doings being noticed and discussed. And if it is Gandalf," he added as an afterthought, "we can give him a little surprise, to pay him out for being so late. Let's get out of sight." The other two ran quickly to the left and down into a little hollow not far from the road. There they lay flat. Frodo hesitated for a second. Curiosity or some other feeling was struggling with his desire to hide. The sound of hoofs drew nearer. Just in time he threw himself down in a patch of long grass behind a tree that overshadowed the road. Then he lifted his head and peered cautiously above one of the great roots. Round the corner came a black horse. No hobbit pony, but a full-sized horse, and on it sat a large man, who seemed to crouch in the saddle, wrapped in a great black cloak and hood, so that only his boots in the high stirrups showed below. His face was shadowed and invisible. When it reached the tree and was level with Frodo, the horse stopped. The riding figure sat quite still with its head bowed, as if listening. From inside the hood came a noise as of someone sniffing to catch an elusive scent. The head turned from side to side of the road. The sudden, unreasoning fear of discovery laid hold of Frodo, and he thought of his ring. He hardly dared to breathe, and yet the desire to get it out of his pocket became so strong that he began slowly to move his hand. He felt that he had only to slip it on, and then he would be safe. The advice of Gandalf seemed absurd. Bilbo had used the ring. "And I am still in the Shire," he thought, as his hand touched the chain on which it hung. At that moment the rider sat up and shook the reins. The horse stepped forward, walking slowly at first, and then breaking into a quick trot. Frodo crawled to the edge of the road and watched the rider, until he dwindled into the distance. He could not be quite sure, but it seemed to him that suddenly, before it passed out of sight, the horse turned aside and went into the trees on the right.
"Well, I call that very queer, and indeed disturbing," said Frodo to himself, as he walked towards his companions. Pippin and Sam had remained flat in the grass, and had seen nothing, so Frodo described the rider and his strange behaviour.
"I can't say why, but I felt certain he was looking or smelling for me, and also I felt certain that I didn't want him to discover me. I've never seen or felt anything like it in the Shire before."
"But what has one of the big people got to do with us?" said Pippin. "And what is he doing in this part of the world?"
"There are some men about," said Frodo. "Down in the South Farthing they have had trouble with big people, I believe. But I have never heard of anything like this rider. I wonder where he comes from."
"Begging your pardon," put in Sam suddenly, "I know where he comes from. It's from Hobbiton that this here black rider comes, unless there's more than one, and I know where he's going to."
"What do you mean?" said Frodo sharply, looking at him in astonishment. "Why didn't you speak up before?"
"I've only just remembered, sir. It was like this. When I got back to our hole yesterday evening with the key, my dad, he says to me, 'Hello, Sam,' he says,
"I thought you were away with Mr. Frodo this morning. There's been a strange customer asking for Mr. Baggins of Bag End, and he's only just gone. I've sent him on to Bucklebury. Not that I liked the sound of him. He seemed mighty put out when I told him Mr. Baggins had left his old home for good. Hissed at me, he did. It gave me quite a shudder. 'What sort of fellow was he?' says I to the gaffer. 'I don't know,' says he, 'but he wasn't a hobbit. He was tall and black-like, and he stooped over me. I reckon it was one of the big folk from foreign parts. He spoke funny.' 'I couldn't stay here more, sir, since you were waiting, and I didn't give much heed to it myself. The gaffer is getting old, and more than a bit blind, and it must have been near dark when this fellow came up the hill and found him taking the air at the end of our row. I hope he hasn't done no harm, sir, nor me.' 'The gaffer can't be blamed anyway,' said Frodo. 'As a matter of fact, I heard him talking to a stranger who seemed to be inquiring for me, and I nearly went and asked him who it was. I wish I had, or you'd told me about it before. I might have been more careful on the road.'
"Still, there may be no connection between this rider and the gaffer's stranger," said Pippin. "We left Hobbiton secretly enough, and I don't see how he could have followed us." "What about the smelling, sir?" said Sam. "And the gaffer said he was a black chap."
"I wish I had waited for Gandalf," Frodo muttered. "But perhaps it would have only made matters worse."
"Then you know or guess something about this rider?" said Pippin, who had caught the muttered words.
"I don't know, and I'd rather not guess," said Frodo.
"All right, cousin Frodo, you can keep your secret for the present, if you want to be mysterious. In the meanwhile, what are we to do? I should like a bite and a sup, but somehow I think we'd better move on from here. Your talk of sniffing riders with invisible noses has unsettled me."
"Yes, I think we'll move on now," said Frodo, "but not on the road, in case that rider comes back, or another follows him. We ought to do a good step more today. Buckland is still miles away." The shadows of the trees were long and thin on the grass as they started off again. They now kept a stone's throw to the left of the road, and kept out of sight of it as much as they could. But this hindered them, for the grass was thick and tussocky, and the ground uneven, and the trees began to draw together into thickets. The sun had gone down red behind the hills at their backs, and evening was coming on before they came back to the road at the end of the long level over which it had run straight for some miles. At that point it bent left and went down into the lowlands of the Yale, making for Stock, but a lane branched right, winding through a wood of ancient oak trees on its way to Woodhall. "That is the way for us," said Frodo. Not far from the road meeting, they came on the huge hulk of a tree. It was still alive and had leaves on the small branches that it had put out round the broken stumps of its long fallen limbs. But it was hollow, and could be entered by a great crack on the side away from the road. The hobbits crept inside, and sat there upon a floor of old leaves and decayed wood. They rested and had a light meal, talking quietly and listening from time to time. Twilight was about them as they crept back to the lane. The west wind was sighing in the branches. Leaves were whispering. Soon the road began to fall gently but steadily into the dusk. A star came out above the trees in the darkening east before them. They went abreast and in step to keep up their spirits. After a time, as the stars grew thicker and brighter, the feeling of disquiet left them, and they no longer listened for the sound of hooves. They began to hum softly, as hobbits have a way of doing as they walk along, especially when they are drawing near to home at night. With most hobbits, it is a supper song or a bed song, but these hobbits hummed a walking song, though not, of course, without any mention of supper and bed. Bilbo Baggins had made the words to a tune that was as old as the hills, and taught it to Frodo as they walked in the lanes of the water valley and talked about adventure.
Upon the hearth the fire is red, beneath the roof there is a bed, but not yet weary are our feet, still round the corner we may meet a sudden tree or a standing stone that none have seen but we alone. Tree and flower and leaf and grass, let them pass, let them pass. Hill and water and the sky, pass them by, pass them by. Still round the corner there may wait a new road or a secret gate, and though we pass them by today, tomorrow we may come this way and take the hidden paths that run towards the moon or to the sun. Apple, thorn and knot and sloe, let them go, let them go. Sand and stone and pool and dell, fare you well, fare you well. Home is behind, the world ahead, and there are many paths to tread, through shadows to the edge of night, until the stars are all alight. Then world behind and home ahead, we'll wander back to home and bed. Mist and twilight, cloud and shade, away shall fade, away shall fade. Fire and lamp and meat and bread, and then to bed, and then to bed. The song ended.
And now to bed, and now to bed,
sang Pippin in a high voice. Hush, said Frodo, I think I hear hooves again. They stopped suddenly and stood as silent as tree shadows, listening. There was a sound of hooves in the lane, some way behind, but coming slow and clear down the wind. Quickly and quietly they slipped off the path, and ran into the deeper shade under the oak trees. "Don't let us go too far," said Frodo. "I don't want to be seen, but I want to see if it's another Black Rider."
"Very well," said Pippin. "But don't forget the sniffing."
The hooves drew nearer. They had no time to find any hiding place better than the general darkness under the trees. Sam and Pippin crouched behind the large tree bole, while Frodo crept back a few yards towards the lane. It showed grey and pale, a line of fading light through the wood. Above it the stars were thick in the dim sky, but there was no moon. The sound of hoofs stopped. As Frodo watched, he saw something dark pass across the lighter space between two trees and then halt. It looked like the black shade of a horse led by a smaller black shadow. The black shadow stood close to the point where they had left the path, and it swayed from side to side. Frodo thought he heard the sound of snuffling. The shadow bent to the ground and then began to crawl towards him. Once more the desire to slip on the ring came over Frodo, but this time it was stronger than before, so strong that, almost before he realized what he was doing, his hand was groping in his pocket. But at that moment there came a sound like mingled song and laughter. Clear voices rose and fell in the starlit air. The black shadow straightened up and retreated. It climbed onto the shadowy horse and seemed to vanish across the lane into the darkness on the other side. Frodo breathed again.
"Elves!" exclaimed Sam in a hoarse whisper. "Elves, sir!"
He would have burst out of the trees and dashed off towards the voices if they had not pulled him back.
"Yes, it is elves," said Frodo.
"One can meet them sometimes in the woody end. They don't live in the Shire, but they wander into it in spring and autumn, out of their own lands, away beyond the Tower Hills. I am thankful that they do. You did not see, but that Black Rider stopped just here and was actually crawling towards us when the song began. As soon as he heard the voices, he slipped away."
"What about the elves?" said Sam, too excited to trouble about the rider. "Can't we go and see them?"
"Listen, they are coming this way," said Frodo. "We have only to wait." The singing drew nearer. One clear voice rose now above the others. It was singing in the fair elven tongue, of which Frodo knew only a little, and the others knew nothing. Yet the sound, blending with the melody, seemed to shape itself in their thoughts into words which they only partly understood. This was the song as Frodo heard it.
"Snow White, Snow White, O Lady Clear, O Queen beyond the western seas. O light to us that wander here amid the world of woven trees. Gilthoniel, O Elbereth, clear are thy eyes and bright thy breath. Snow White, Snow White, we sing to thee in a far land beyond the sea. O stars that in the sunless year with shining hand by her were sown, in windy fields now bright and clear we see your silver blossom blown. O Elbereth, Gilthoniel, we still remember, we who dwell in this far land beneath the trees, thy starlight on the western seas.
The song ended. These are high elves. They spoke the name of Elbereth, said Frodo in amazement. Few of that fairest folk are ever seen in the Shire. Not many now remain in Middle-earth, east of the great sea. This is indeed a strange chance. The hobbits sat in shadow by the wayside. Before long the elves came down the lane toward the valley. They passed slowly, and the hobbits could see the starlight glimmering on their hair and in their eyes. They bore no lights, yet as they walked a shimmer, like the light of the moon above the rim of the hills before it rises, seemed to fall about their feet. They were now silent, and as the last elf passed, he turned and looked towards the hobbits and laughed.
"Hail, Frodo!" he cried. "You're abroad late, or are you perhaps lost?"
Then he called aloud to the others, and all the company stopped and gathered round.
"This is indeed wonderful," they said. "Three hobbits in a wood at night? We have not seen such a thing since Bilbo went away. What is the meaning of it?"
"The meaning of it, fair people," said Frodo, "is simply that we seem to be going the same way as you are. I like walking under the stars, but I would welcome your company."
"But we have no need of other company, and hobbits are so dull," they laughed. "And how do you know that we go the same way as you? For you do not know whither we are going."
"And how do you know my name?" asked Frodo in return.
"We know many things," they said. "We have seen you often before with Bilbo, though you may not have seen us."
"Who are you, and who is your lord?" asked Frodo.
"I am Gildor," answered their leader, the elf who had first hailed him. "Gildor and Glorian of the House of Finrod. We are exiles, and most of our kindred have long ago departed, and we too are now only tarrying here a while, ere we return over the great sea. But some of our kinsfolk dwell still in peace in Rivendell. Come now, Frodo, tell us what you are doing, for we see that there is some shadow of fear upon you."
"Oh, wise people," interrupted Pippin eagerly, "tell us about the Black Riders."
"Black Riders?" they said in low voices.
"Why do you ask about Black Riders?"
"Because two Black Riders have overtaken us today, or one has done so twice," said Pippin. "Only a little while ago he slipped away as you drew near."
The elves did not answer at once, but spoke together softly in their own tongue. At length Gildor turned to the hobbits. "We will not speak of this here," he said. "We think you had best come now with us. It is not our custom, but for this time we will take you on our road, and you shall lodge with us tonight, if you will."
"Oh, fair folk, this is good fortune beyond my hope," said Pippin.
Sam was speechless. "I thank you indeed, Gildor and Glorian," said Frodo, bowing. "Elen sila lumen nomenti elvo. A star shines on the hour of our meeting," he added in the high elven speech.
"Be careful, friends," cried Gildor, laughing. "Speak no secrets. Here is a scholar in the ancient tongue. Bilbo was a good master. Hail, elf friend," he said, bowing to Frodo. "Come now with your friends and join our company. You had best walk in the middle, so that you may not stray. You may be weary before we halt."
"Why? "Where are you going?" asked Frodo. "For tonight we go to the woods on the hills above Woodhall. It is some miles, but you shall have rest at the end of it, and it will shorten your journey tomorrow." They now marched on again in silence, and passed like shadows and faint lights, for elves, even more than hobbits, could walk when they wished without sound or footfall. Pippin soon began to feel sleepy, and staggered once or twice, but each time a tall elf at his side put out his arm and saved him from a fall. Sam walked along at Frodo's side, as if in a dream, with an expression on his face half of fear and half of astonished joy. The woods on either side became denser. The trees were now younger and thicker, and as the lane went lower, running down into a fold of the hills, there were many deep breaks of hazel on the rising slopes at either hand. At last the elves turned aside from the path. A green ride lay almost unseen through the thickets on the right, and this they followed as it wound away back up the wooded slopes onto the top of a shoulder of the hills that stood out into the lower land of the river valley. Suddenly they came out of the shadows of the trees, and before them lay a wide space of grass, grey under the night. On three sides the woods pressed upon it, but eastward the ground fell steeply, and the tops of the dark trees, growing at the bottom of the slope, were below their feet. Beyond, the lowlands lay dim and flat under the stars. Nearer at hand a few lights twinkled in the village of Woodhall. The elves sat on the grass and spoke together in soft voices. They seemed to take no further notice of the hobbits. Frodo and his companions wrapped themselves in cloaks and blankets, and drowsiness stole over them. The night grew on, and the lights in the valley went out. Pippin fell asleep, pillowed on a green hillock. Away high in the east swung Remmereth, the netted stars, and slowly above the mists red Borgil rose, glowing like a jewel of fire. Then by some shift of airs all the mist was drawn away like a veil, and there leaned up, as he climbed over the rim of the world, the swordsman of the sky, Menelvagor, with his shining belt. The elves all burst into song. Suddenly under the trees a fire sprang up with a red light. "Come!" the elves called to the hobbits. "Come! Now is the time for speech and merriment!" Pippin sat up and rubbed his eyes. He shivered. "There is a fire in the hall, and food for hungry guests," said an elf standing before him. At the south end of the green sward there was an opening. There the green floor ran on into the wood, and formed a wide space like a hall, roofed by the boughs of trees. Their great trunks ran like pillars down each side. In the middle there was a wood fire blazing, and upon the tree pillars torches with lights of gold and silver were burning steadily. The elves sat round the fire upon the grass, or upon the sawn rings of old trunks. Some went to and fro bearing cups and pouring drink. Others brought food on heaped plates and dishes. "This is poor fare," they said to the hobbits,